Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk Nation Radio, we get surprising insights from a practicing clinical psychiatrist on how uniquely inactive U.S. citizens are.
Millions of people hit the streets of Mexico City and then the Orange Revolution in 2004 in the Ukraine, one after another around the world, when people have gotten ripped off in just that one area, elections, they hit the streets. Well, you take a look at the U.S. and our area of disputed elections and, you know, almost complete passivity.
And on how we got this way.
If people learn that over and over again what they can do has no impact on stopping the pain in their life, they end up giving up trying. And I think part of what's happened with folks in this, putting all their democracy eggs into the one basket of electoral politics, has created this learned helplessness.
And how we can be cured of our passivity.
Intelligent, wise activists over the years, over the centuries, have realized that. And they've realized that, you know, when you've got that huge majority who are in that position of, like, knowing what's going on, knowing that they're getting exploited, knowing they're getting victimized, you know, but they just don't have the energy to do something about it, is that you have to provide something to reduce their pain.
I'm thrilled to have as this week's guest on Talk Nation Radio, Bruce Levine. Bruce's most recent book, and it is a great one, is Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. Bruce is a practicing clinical psychologist, often at odds with his profession, including that profession's affection for pharmaceutical drugs. Bruce was kind enough to speak at a conference I helped organize last year and brought down the house, and his remarks, or something close to them, became a chapter in the book The Military-Industrial Complex at 50. Bruce is probably the best writer and speaker I know on the topic of why we are not more active and how we can come to be so. Bruce Levine, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Great to be on with you, David.
It is wonderful to have your voice here. We in the United States sit by for blatantly stolen elections. We elect presidents and congresses to do something, and they do the opposite, and we remain with our posteriors glued to our sofas. Wall Street bankers manufacture crises that over 90% of us believe they should be allowed to suffer through with their own heartless medicine, yet our government bails them out with trillions of our dollars, and we yawn. Would other nations be getting up and standing up? Are we uniquely inactive?
I think we are more inactive than lots of other nations. I mean, one of the things that led to that Get Up, Stand Up book was the end of 2009. I was taking a look at the see, just one area. You mentioned several areas of our passivity, but one was in response to disputed presidential elections. And I was saying what the Iranians did after their disputed presidential election in 2009. I mean, and they had millions of people who were, they were told that if they get out on the street, they'll get shot, and some were shot, but that didn't stop them. And then I took a look at I started to think about Mexico in 2006 when their progressive guy was unfair election there. Millions of people hit the streets of Mexico City, and then the Orange Revolution in 2004 in the Ukraine, one after another around the world, when people have gotten ripped off in just that one area, elections, they hit the streets. Well, you take a look at the U.S. and our area of disputed elections, and, you know, almost complete passivity. I mean, you got to, especially I was thought about the one in 2000, but there have been several others, but the one in 2000 was really striking because, you know, Al Gore, he had 500,000 more votes than George W. I mean, you had 50 million people who thought highly of him. I mean, I wasn't this huge fan of him, but a lot of people thought, you know, they had voted for him. And, you know, the Supreme Court stops this recount in Florida. One of the Supreme Court justices is saying, you know, this we will never really be able to respect the judges again. I mean, this is just one thing after another. All these inflammatory things were happening in the U.S. in 2000, and almost nothing happened, no protest. And I remember thinking at the time in 2000, if I was Bush and Cheney, I mean, that would have told me, boy, we can get away with just about anything. I mean, nobody nobody's going to really care. Nobody's going to protest. So, you know, there were a lot of areas. You mentioned the wars. I mean, I thought about a lot about that in 2009, about how if you looked at the polls, 60-65% of the people were opposing these wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, all these other little wars we had all over the place. Very little resistance. In fact, there was much more resistance in when these wars began, when the polls showed that most Americans actually supported them because they believed in the government lies. And so issue after issue, you see that the polls show that people oppose these policies of this corporate elite, this corporate state, this corporatocracy, this combination of ridiculously wealthy people like the Koch brothers and their collaborating politicians and these giant corporations who are ruling this country. People oppose that, but there is very little resistance. Now, there has been some since that book came out, and I was pleased that that I found that some of the Occupy organizers got a hold of it when the book came out in April 2011. That's when it came out, and that they were utilizing that. So since the book's come out, we've had some more, but really not that many people on the street. But, you know, even in the bigger places like Oakland and New York and in D.C., you really don't have a huge numbers of people, you know. And so, and the rest of America here, I mean, I'm in Cincinnati, Ohio here, and they're lucky if they get a couple hundred people in their Occupy movement in any given day. Mostly it's like 20, 30 people, and that's the way it is throughout a lot of the rest of the country.
And is the reason for this that we have a two-party system and we're just stuck with that and that binds our hands and that we have been sold that wars are patriotic, or are there reasons for our passivity that go more closely to your profession, to our psychology?
Yeah, I mean, one thing, I mean, is the whole idea of learned helplessness, which, again, you got to watch my profession. You got to watch psychologists and psychiatrists. They either talk about stuff that's complete nonsense or they make a big deal with jargon out of obvious common sense. And I think this obvious common sense is really what this whole idea of learned helplessness is about, which really is that if people learn that over and over again what they can do has no impact on stopping the pain in their life, they end up giving up trying. And I think part of what's happened with folks in this putting all their democracy eggs into the one basket of electoral politics has created this learned helplessness when you have these both corporate parties, that the only parties that have a chance of winning, these Democrats, Republicans. So people have found that, hey, you know, if the Republicans are in power, certainly you have corporate control and senseless wars. So they get, well, maybe we'll go and vote for a Democrat. We'll put Obama in 2008. Well, what did you get? Senseless wars and corporate control. And, you know, back in 2000, people tried real hard with the Green Party, you know, and the way it stacked in our country here with how much money controls the electoral process, you know, third party really like that has no chance. And then they got screamed at by from the Democrats saying, well, it was your fault here. And then what else can you do? You can just stay home and give up, which is what a lot of people do, 40-50% in national presidential elections, a lot more in off-year elections. And what do they you still get, you know, Democrats or Republicans win, and you get senseless wars and corporate control. And then they get screamed at and saying, well, it was their fault because they stayed home and they have no one. They can't complain. So whenever what you do doesn't create a change, you move into this kind of learned helplessness. And so you got to think about certain areas where you get more learned helpless. And I mean, I'm not telling people to give up completely on electoral politics, especially if it energizes them, but they got to look for other kind of democracy battlefields where they're not going to feel so helpless.
Bruce Levine, in your book, Get Up, Stand Up, you go through a number of quite interesting additional sort of systemic factors that may be reducing our activism, including our greed and materialism, our viewing of television as a medium itself, not to mention how bad the content of our media is, our incarceration rates, and our practice of drugging people, including people with something called oppositional defiant disorder. Can you speak about some of these factors and what in the world that could be?
Well, I go through a lot of different areas that I think that are pacifying and subduing people, but I want to make sure that I kind of focus on my own profession, too. People should get toughest on what their own particular profession, I think. And my profession has been, I think, pacifying, subduing anti-authoritarians for quite some time now. And this oppositional defiant disorder. This is an illness that they just invented. I mean, these illnesses, people got to understand. The American Psychiatric Association has this a diagnostic Bible called the DSM, and they just decide by committee what's an illness and what's not. In 1980, and this is an interesting year, 1980, as America becomes even more authoritarian, Ronald Reagan becomes president, and my profession sort of follows. They always kind of sort of follow in lockstep here with what's going on, and so they create a new diagnosis. The American Psychiatric Association creates this diagnosis called oppositional defiant disorder, ODD, which the symptoms are, often argue with adults, often refuse to comply with adults' requests and rules. I mean, it's not even, these kids are not even doing anything illegal. I mean, that's a whole other diagnosis. That's conduct disorder. So the old-time juvenile delinquents, they would be labeled with conduct disorder. These ODD kids, I mean, these, you know, I remember when I was in graduate school at the time, I was telling my, professors, and I was saying, geez, don't you realize every great activist in American history, almost everyone, would have been labeled with ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, Saul Alinsky and Emma Goldman and all these folks, and Albert Einstein. I mean, all these folks would have been labeled with ODD, and, well, you know, that didn't seem to make too much of an impact on them. So my profession is certainly getting scary, because a lot of these ODD kids, a lot of the other people who are diagnosed with even depression, anxiety disorder, substance abuse, if you kind of hang out with them, a lot of them are anti-authoritarians, and a lot of the pain that's fueling their self-destructive behaviors is often the pain of their fear that if they do not comply with illegitimate authorities in their lives, in the workplace or wherever, that they will be marginalized economically. But if they do comply, they're afraid that they will lose self-respect. And so that kind of pain will fuel all kinds of self-destructive behaviors. And so what are we doing in my profession? Well, we're increasingly drugging those people. I mean, and that's a pretty scary thing. So I think that's one of many spokes in the wheel here that is causing this pacification of Americans. But the good news is here is if you understand all of these different spokes, you don't have to wait for national elections here to move into fighting for democracy. You realize that there's that if in your profession, and we can talk about what goes on in schools with teachers and a lot of these different things, that you can be helping the cause by making sure a lot of people who are essential would be on the democracy battlefield. They're essential anti-authoritarians. They're not lost, that they eventually will be able to get some political consciousness and join the fight.
So what do we do? We're speaking with Bruce Levine, who is an expert on this topic, which comes up at the end of every activist event. What do we do about it? And I highly recommend Bruce's book, Get Up, Stand Up. But tell our listeners, what are some steps we can take as organizations and as individuals to overcome this defeatism and the drugs and the television and the incarceration and everything else and become as active as the situation calls for?
Well, one big area that I think we need to do is building a base, and obviously, again, we don't have enough numbers yet, and so any which way that we can to kind of build a larger base, and there's many different ways to build a larger base of people fighting for democracy here and fighting for government that is truly of, by, and for the people. I mean, and one way that I think about a lot is that there is this kind of divide among people who are anti-authoritarians, and the divide is really a divide of people who are a little more comfortable versus folks who I consider totally in pain, totally afflicted. And when I talk about the comfortable anti-authoritarians, I mean, I'm not using that term pejoratively. I'm not, using like we used to talk about limousine liberals and the bourgeois, and all this kind of stuff. The reality is there are some anti-authoritarians that have some money in their bank. They have maybe a decent professor job or a pension, or they have a voice like you and I right now. You know, we're talking and there's actually people listening to what we have to say, and we're not completely socially isolated. But from my experience, especially working with clientele for over 28 years, there's a lot of people out there who are just completely hurting. Their life is a financial disaster. They got, student loans, that their monthly payments are making it, they're not going to be able to ever buy a house. They're nobody cares what they have to say. About the only time anybody hears what they have to say is maybe they call in talk radio shows in desperation that somebody will listen to what they have to say. They're socially isolated. So they're an overwhelming amount of pain. And when you're in that kind of zone, And I have in my life kind of sort of traveled this continuum some from being more afflicted to more comfortable. But when you're in this more afflicted zone, more speeches, more lectures, more sermons of how crappy and how rotten and how bad you're being exploited, they just don't cut it. They just, you're already in pain, and to hear all that stuff is just painful, and it's usually just a turnoff. So a lot of what activists, intelligent, wise activists over the years, over the centuries, have realized that. They've understood that, and they've realized that, you know, when you've got that huge majority who are in that position of, like, knowing what's going on, knowing that they're getting exploited, knowing they're getting victimized, you know, but they just don't have the energy to do something about it, is that you have to provide something to reduce their pain. And we can talk about some of the different the ways that are practical to do that.
Yes, please. Let's
yeah, I mean, one of the things that was really interesting for me when we were at that the military-industrial conference at 50, one of the speakers that we had there who really also did, thank you for also the kind words you said about me, but one of the other speakers that really, I know, impressed the crowd there was a young guy named Jonathan Williams, who was from the Civilian Soldier Alliance. And what he realized was that, you know, hey, the same thing that people realized back in the Vietnam era is that a lot of these soldiers, I mean, there are, you talk about people who are afflicted in overwhelming pain, that's a group for sure, and that you just can't, you know, try to proselytize and sermonize and lecture these folks. What you have to do is kind of give them something. And so the idea back in the Vietnam era was, and Jonathan and their Civilian Soldier Alliance has continued this with today with soldiers, is that you create coffee houses, the GI coffee houses near military bases, places where these guys can just go off base and just hang out and feel okay for a little bit, maybe get some free coffee, maybe, you know, have some good conversation. And they're already now they're in a different head. You know, you've provided something for them. You're not just trying to kind of like change their point of view here. You're not just trying to make them feel bad about their immorality or any of that kind of stuff. You've given them something. And once you've given somebody even a small thing like that, some coffee and some conversation, people are start to, open up. And, you know, and that's, that kind of process has gone on historically. One of the movements that I go into great detail in Get Up Stand Up was the great populist movement in America, which was in the 1880s, 1890s. And for folks in your audience who don't know anything about that, it's really the Great Farmers' Revolt, the Great Agrarian Revolt, probably according to historians, especially Lawrence Goodwin, who's the most famous historian of the populist movement, it's the largest democratic mass movement in American history. And it scared the hell out of the wealthy. I mean, they almost won in a lot of ways. I mean, really, it was these farmers were getting horrible prices for their crops, and a lot of them were having to force to sell their crops and become sharecroppers themselves. And it was, they're forced to sell their farms. And so one of the things these guys came up with, who were the organizers, something called the Alliance, was they realized, look, what can we pull off here? Well, let's do something like create these producer co-ops, where they cut out the middlemen, and they worked these co-ops out so that these farmers were all of a sudden getting better prices for their crop. I mean, that was going to reduce their pain. I mean, you know, that was going to make them feel good, and it was also a great recruiting tool. So, you know, anything out there that you can kind of reduce people's pain without being exploitative, without being a demagogue. And I have to tell folks that that's what demagogues do to meet their own needs. I mean, they throw folks a false bone, you know, to give them a scapegoat or something like that out there to kind of like reduce their pain psychologically to rip them off. And you don't want to do that if you care about a democratic movement. But you do have to care about people's basic psychology, that if somebody out there is overwhelmed by the pains and miseries of their life, just the truth is not going to be enough to set them free.
You also have written about immigrant communities as people that current residents of the United States can learn from because they're bringing a more activist culture to us. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I think if you take a look at American history, and you can see it in recent American history here, even with the Latino community, is that it seems like for each generation that you're here in America, that immigrants come over, and obviously everybody was an immigrant once here. This is an entire immigrant society, except for Native Americans here. For each generation that people are over here, they get pacified, they get broken. So the most recent folks who are over here are the Latin Latin Americans. And when they, several years back, when they were talking about imposing these draconian laws, and they actually, it was a law that actually already passed the House that was going to impose all kinds of, it was almost like a fugitive slave act for illegal immigrants. I mean, they really organized and they really got out on the street and they scared the hell out of the Senate. The Senate never voted on it, and there were hundreds of thousands, you know, in every city. I mean, big city, you know, L.A. had over 500,000 people out on the streets, but even cities where there were not huge Latino communities, like Denver and wherever, that they still had lots of people out there. And so I think that one of the things that also kind of is like more evidence for me is that the more you're over here in the United States, this is a sort of scary place in terms of breaking our spirit of resistance. And and to take a look at what are the things that they haven't been exposed to yet that has not broken their spirit of resistance. And so, one that hits home really is that the more you're here in the United States, the more that your group becomes socially isolated, and you need solidarity to have any kind of democratic movement. And the more you're here in the U.S., well, one statistic that's really sort of scary for me is that 25% of Americans do not have a single confidant in their life, somebody to talk to, and that number is just increased 250% in the last 25 years. And so people have to be wary, of like how easy it is to just become completely isolated, completely overwhelmed by debt, student loan debt, television, and all kinds of things that just kind of make one more passive. And my profession, school systems, lots of different things in our culture here that I don't think it's sort of conspiratorial at the top that they've all organized this here to kind of weaken us and pacify us. But anything out there that makes people a lot of money, that keeps people more passive, is certainly something that's going to be that's certainly not going to be confronted by the corporate media.
To hear you, Bruce, describe a march of 500,000 people as an example of how things should be done, exemplified by the immigrants' rights movement, of course, hits my ear a little funny as someone living in the peace movement and hearing constantly, oh, we turned out 500,000 people, we turned out 300,000 people, and we marched around on a Saturday, and it didn't do a darn bit of good, and the wars kept going, and we need to do something different. But if you go back and you look at the memoirs from people like George W. Bush about what was going on in 05 and 06, when you had the anti-war activists lined up with the anti-Republican war activists, you see that the pressure really was being felt, and that behind closed doors, these people were talking about the need to scale back and end the war because of the pressure, whereas publicly, they'll never suggest that you're having any impact whatsoever. Do you think that sometimes we do have more impact than we're aware of, and that there is a concerted effort by those in power to not let us know about that?
Yes, absolutely. And it works. It worked on me. I mean, I tell you one of the things, back, I'm old enough to kind of be a kid, sort of like a young teenager during the kind of Vietnam protests, and I was like 15, 16 going to these gigantic rallies in Washington, D.C., and you had this kind of sense like it didn't really matter. They didn't give a damn. They were quite effective at like making people feel like, you know, it was totally, you know, worthless to do that. And actually sort of still rolled around in the back of my head, well, really, was it? I mean, did we have any kind of impact? And only years later did I kind of discover that one of the great things that did have a clear impact in ending that war in Vietnam was the soldiers' own resistance that I mentioned earlier. I mean, there was violent resistance, fragging officers, throwing hand grenades in tents, that kind of thing. But more often, I mean, there was a lot of passive resistance. There was a lot of guys there was desertion. There was folks just, you know, just smoking pot all day and refusing officers' commands to go out in the field. And you had a U.S. Army, you had all these military services terrified that if this Vietnam War continued, that they would have their toys, their services would just not be there anymore. And one of the things that I discovered only later was that what really encouraged a lot of those soldiers, who really took the most courage, there was nothing more courageous. You know, it was easy for all of us to just get out on the street and to kind of protest, but it really took those guys a lot of courage to really defy their superiors and risk court-martial and all that kind of thing. And really what I discovered later, though, that they were encouraged, though, this is a big deal, that really our role of all of us on the streets, the 500,000 in Washington, D.C., and these constant, you know, anti-war rallies, that major role that we provided was indirectly through encouraging those guys that they knew that by doing that, once if they did leave the military, that there would be communities that would really support them, and so it had a really great effect, and maybe in the most important ways that war really did end, which was through these soldiers' own withdrawal of cooperation with the authorities.
We don't have a lot of time left. You mentioned briefly the Occupy movement. You mentioned the need for confidants and community. How important is that for face-to-face, real-world, offline activism to be part of the solution?
I mean, certainly, you know, people need to discover how they're being oppressed. I mean, you know, that is important. But a lot of what's neglected a little bit too much by organizers is that the importance of having energy and having solidarity. And that's why the issue of anti-authoritarianism is really huge. And that's why it's, you know, a lot of Americans out there, if you talk to them, I mean, some of them have really been beaten down. But there is a really deep thread of, well, not all, but a lot of folks who are anti-authoritarian, which means that they, you know, they question whether an authority is legitimate or not before they comply with it. And if, you know, and what happens, you know, the huge importance of maintaining anti-authoritarianism, which is what I care a lot about doing what I do for a living as a psychologist, is that it really creates energy when you delegitimize an illegitimate authority. There's energy that comes from that, but also too, when you support, and this is very important, when you support anybody out there who is defying illegitimate authorities, who is challenging illegitimate authorities, resisting those authorities, whether they are in government or corporations or even in school systems or in any institution, this, when you support somebody who's doing it, that's how you get real solidarity. I mean, that's where you really build those bonds, which are hugely necessary for democratic movements. And that's what democratic movements need. They need base building. They need energy. They need solidarity. They also need something. This will be the real fun when we get to this, is they really also need to get better at just getting along with one another. I mean, and so they don't get divided and conquered.
Do we need to carry that to the point of building alliances as anti-authoritarians across the left to right political spectrum as well? Just
well,
briefly.
I think this is a great question, and I think that there's certainly lots of I know you probably do as well as I, but get on a lot of these libertarian talk shows, which there are a lot more bigger audiences, and there are a lot more libertarian talk radio shows out there than there are on the left. I mean, that's what I found. And, you know, certainly there are sharp disagreements I have with some of these people on health care and a lot of other issues. But what I found over the years is that when you get on that kind of libertarian Ron Paul, Alex Jones world, you know, that these guys, you know, they have contempt. They have probably more contempt, as much contempt for the Republican Party as a lot of people on left anti-authoritarians have for the Democratic Party. I mean, and there's a lot of areas that you can form coalitions on. And actually, Ron Paul and Ralph Nader have actually talked about the fact that, yes, there's sharp disagreements. So forget about having any kind of political party. But in terms of specific issues, coalitions on anti-war, coalitions on, you know, people restoring liberties here and getting, you know, government, you know, surveillance out of their life, you know, a lot of different areas, and I think it's really always smart to have conversations with kind of open-minded anti-authoritarians to see what you could form coalitions on.
This is Talk Nation Radio. We've been speaking with Bruce Levine, the author of the wonderful book Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. His website is brucelevine.net. Go tell all of your libertarian radio stations to air this program every week. Bruce, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.